Hello, and welcome to another edition of Talking Travel Literature. My name is Bob Fisher, and as usual, I'm joined by my colleague and fellow travel journalist, Peter Flaherty. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Bob.
Well, are you all set to indulge again in a little vicarious literary travel?
I'm really looking forward to today's trip because we're going to be on our way to Venice, which is the city that forms the setting, and really even more than the setting, for a very interesting book by John Berendt called The City of Falling Angels.
Good. Well, tell us more about the book. The title is The City of Falling Angels. The author is John Berendt. And who is John Berendt?
John Berendt is quite a well-known author. His first book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, really made his fame, I think, as an author in the genre of literary nonfiction. It's set in the city of Savannah, and with a cast of fascinating characters, was made into a very popular film, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1995. In this book, I think he kind of reprises that. He sets it in Venice, which is another very interesting and somewhat bizarre city. The characters in the book are certainly very strange people, and he tells an interesting story.
And I should also mention that at the end of our chat today, we'll be running the interview that Roy conducted recently with John Berendt himself. So Listeners out there will get another straight from the horse's mouth perspective. But just before we get started, can we chat briefly about what you just mentioned, this literary nonfiction thing? And literary nonfiction, by the way, has surpassed the sale of fiction in the retail market. Mm-hmm. And that's something, obviously, of great concern to authors of fiction and people that like to read fiction. But I'm wondering, Peter, in a nutshell, what would you say literary nonfiction is and why is it so popular?
Well, I think with people like the author we're talking about today, John Berendt, he's really very good at setting a place and characters in a way that really makes them seem like fictional characters. I mean, these are real people he's talking about, and yet the way he describes them with all their foibles and eccentricities and sometimes weird behavior, you do really feel like you're reading a novel. And I think one of the really interesting and fascinating things about this genre of writing is that it can take you to a place, you can get a sense of place and a sense of important things that are going on, and at the same time really feel like you're reading something that's from a different world. Many of Berendt's characters seem larger than life and sometimes almost hard to believe that they really exist.
Well, I have to admit, I did a little bit of Googling my own on the whole literary nonfiction genre, and there are obviously classics in this field, and one of them best known is Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. But what other forms of, other than travel, obviously Capote was writing a sociological literary nonfiction book, but what other types of nonfiction would be classified as literary?
Besides travel, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I think that probably books dealing with contemporary political issues, social issues. There's a very wonderful Australian writer. We should maybe talk about him someday on one of these little discussions that we have. Peter Robb, who's written a book called Midnight in Sicily, another book, A Death in Brazil, and these are really political studies of current social issues and upheavals. And in the case of Midnight in Sicily, he's talking about crime. So I think that there are many subjects that can be touched on in literary nonfiction.
And just before we continue, here's a quote that I found about literary nonfiction, where the writer said, "In a culture saturated by data without context, facts without insight, and information without enlightenment, literary nonfiction holds a special and vital place." And I think you and I obviously agree because we chose this book to talk about today, and The City of Falling Angels certainly is a book, in my opinion, that gives insight as well as information, and above all, it gives enlightenment. So it certainly falls into the literary nonfiction category. So let's get started, and I'd like to start with some words from John Berendt himself. You'll remember that in one of his opening chapters, he tells us why he decided to go and spend some quality time in Venice and why he chose Venice. And this is what he said. My interest in any case was not Venice per se, but people who live in Venice, which is not the same thing. Nor apparently had it been a common approach in books about Venice. The best-known novels and movies set in Venice tended to be about people who were just passing through, and he mentions books like Death in Venice, The Wings of the Dove, Summertime, The Comfort of Strangers, all of which the main characters in the stories, and many more besides, were neither Venetians nor resident expatriates. They were transients. So he says, why Venice? Why did I go to Venice? Because to my mind, Venice was uniquely beautiful, isolated, inward-looking, and a powerful stimulant to the senses, the intellect, and the imagination. You want to comment on that?
Well, I would agree a lot, certainly with his last point. I've been to Venice numerous times. I haven't had the chance to live there for an extended period of time the way John Berendt did, and when I have visited, the city has been overrun with tourists. But even saying that, you do really get a sense when you travel there that Venice is a unique place. It is very inward-looking. It's not really like any other city in Italy, for the obvious reason, of course, that the streets are made of water. But the people have a very different outlook, a very different attitude. It's important to remember that Venice really was, you know, one of the last places to be united with the rest of Italy. So they've kept a very strong sense of local identity that I think Berendt captures in his book.
And again, at the beginning, too, he points out a fact that I really hadn't considered, that Venice is and was for him a lot smaller and much more manageable than for him it seemed at first. It's only 1,800 acres, which Berendt points out is barely twice the size of Central Park.
That's right.
And the other reason he suggests why he went to Venice, because he says it might not be there very long.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of those cities and one of those places in the world, like New Orleans, another city I'm very attached to, that really is on life support. I mean, it's we talk about endangered species. There are also endangered cities, and Venice is right up there. In fact, in the book, he discusses the whole campaign of an American group called Save Venice to raise money to restore some of the cultural sites in the city and preserve it.
Well, it seems to me that right from the beginning of the book, he clearly has established that he's going to be writing about Venice as grand theater. Mm-hmm. And that includes all the dramatic elements that theater and novels contain. Mm-hmm. For example, a great set. Yeah, you know, you couldn't ask for greater sets. The setting itself, characters and characterization, plot, dramatic conflict, and this is the important part, a catalytic event or a crisis that starts the action. So, just, Peter, for the benefit of our listeners, can you do a walk through the book from these points of view?
Well, there's a lot in the book, and I think you're right that it's the sense of grand theater pervades it. In fact, in a very literal way, it's actually an opera theater, an opera house, La Fenice, that burns under very mysterious circumstances in January 1996, shortly before Berendt begins his period of residency in Venice. It's just by chance that he had planned to go there anyway, but the burning of La Fenice is really the entree into the story, and he comes back to it at the end with the trial of the suspects involved. But in the meantime, he's going through a number of other stories. The book is really like the layers of an onion,
and it's kind of the kind of serendipity that a tragic serendipity, but the kind of serendipity that a travel journalist often likes to experience. Mm-hmm. Go on, characters and characterization.
Well, there are a number of people. He talks about the eyewitnesses who were involved in putting out the fire and observing it and all of the different conspiracies. From there, though, he goes to a number of different stories that kind of interrelated in a way, they're all interrelated in the sense that they're taking place in Venice, many of them involving expatriates, many of them involving people who've lived there for, their families have lived there all their lives. For instance, there's a family of glassblowers who are master craftsmen who've worked in Venice for Murano, which is the island where the beautiful glass is made. There's all kinds of problems in the family. The master glassblower is inspired by the burning of La Fenice to turn out incredible works of art that kind of capture the flames and the destruction in glass. There's a group of people who were involved, as I said, in the Save Venice Committee, and there's a lot of squabbling among the various people.
So this is the psychological psychological level that that he puts into
That's
the
right.
novel. And
yes.
He's really writing about the thoughts and the feelings of some of these key characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are many more. There's another group, and there's another quarrel over the possession of the Ezra Pound archives. Pound, of course, the great American poet who died in Venice. And from that, Berendt is able to interweave a number of literary associations with previous writers like Henry James, of course, whose book The Aspen Papers deals with a similar kind of plot of someone attempting to get control of an archive of a fictional writer. I mean, Berendt has a really great way of blending fact and fiction, and sometimes you're not really sure what you're reading. I mean, many.
You mean there's fiction in here? He's made stuff up?
Well, I don't think he's made. I mean, it's hard to say. He does say that there's a great deal of direct quoting and conversations, and in that, when you're reading something like that, it does seem like you're reading a novel. However, he does claim that all of these conversations are based on actual discussions that he had with the people, and he identifies the people. So as a journalist, I mean, we have to take his word for the fact that he isn't making things up. But I don't think he's really exaggerating things, but he's certainly putting his own spin on them. And he comes to Venice like anyone does, really, with his own preconceptions. He obviously loves the place. He's intrigued by it. He's trying to, I used the metaphor of the onion a minute ago, he's trying to peel the various layers or levels and to get to the bedrock of truth. And he realizes that in a place like Venice, that's a dream. That's not going to happen.
So in terms of plot, there are scandals going on. Who burned down the Fenice? Right. And
that's only one of them.
What are the other subplots in the book?
Well, as I said, there's the quarrel among the various members of this family of glassblowers. The son won't speak to the father, and the father is a master of his craft. The intrigues of the Save Venice Committee, the conflict over the possession of the Ezra Pound papers. There's another family that possesses a beautiful Palazzo Barbaro, which is like a famous palazzo in Venice, and they're quite a group in themselves. They can't agree on who should own it and what it should be used for. Each chapter really could be read as a little novella or a vignette, because they all deal with stories that in a way are separate, but at the end of the book, when you finished it, you begin to see a lot of similarities among these various characters of people who walk the stage in Venice.
Okay. Most great dramas and even novels have some kind of denouement or some kind of resolution of the dramatic conflict. Well, I guess the largest dramatic conflict here is Venice sinking, and sinking in many different ways.
Right.
Culturally, who burned down the opera house. But do you think Berendt achieves a resolution to the dramatic conflict he encounters?
I think he reaches a sort of resolution. At the very end of the book, he talks about the opening ceremony after La Fenice is finally restored. The Italian is dov'era, com'ora, which means where it was, as it was. This is the proud boast of the mayor and the construction companies, and there's also a big quarrel about which construction company will end up getting the contract to do the rebuilding. He attends the opening, the inaugural opera, after the opera house is restored, and so you do get a sense that at least has been brought back. However, he leaves it open. He leaves the whole question of Venice's future open, and does say that the ecological time bomb is still ticking, and because of the political machinations and the endemic corruption of the government system, I wouldn't say that his outlook is completely optimistic, no.
What I really like about the book, and why I find it a very literary travel book, is that his style and the story itself are like the tangled streets and canals mm-hmm. of Venice mm-hmm. and the minds and the behavior patterns of the people that he encounters are like that.
Right.
Okay. Are you ready now to do our regular shtick where I pitch you ideas and themes?
And I'll try to hit them.
Right. The ones I think the book contains,
sure.
And you're just going to comment on them.
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
This is like Venice Word Association.
That's right. Venice as a metaphor.
Well, Venice is a metaphor for many things. I mean, authors have been fascinated with the place for such a long time. It's a place where illusion and reality and illusion do blend. It's like nowhere else. So, I mean, I would say that it's a metaphor for transience, for insubstantiability, where you just don't really know whether what you're seeing is real. It might be a reflection. There's sky, there's water, there are buildings that don't look like they could possibly be real. I've had that experience myself in Venice, looking at a palazzo from the Grand Canal when I'm on a Vaporetto, and I wonder whether I'm really seeing it or whether this is a film or a dream, something I've imagined. It's a very dreamlike place, and it's certainly a metaphor for all of the strangeness that we associate with places like that.
I want to throw in one of my favorite $5 words, the ephemeral.
Ephemeral.
Right. What's ephemeral mean?
Well, it's like something you're trying to grasp but can't quite get at it, and I think that's really the way Venice is. You mentioned earlier that even wandering the streets, you get a uncanny sense of deja vu, that you think you've seen the place before, which is probably true. You have, because you've gotten lost and wandered by it a couple of times thinking that you were on your way to wherever it was you wanted to get to. I've lost whole groups of people in Venice when I was trying to get them to Piazza San Marco, and very easy to do that.
As long as you didn't do it deliberately.
No, but that's half the fun of going there, of course.
Okay, here's a comment from one of the main characters, and you can help me with pronunciation. He's a count.
Right.
Girolamo Marcello.
Marcello. Mm-hmm.
And he says, at one point when he's talking to Berent, he says, "Everyone in Venice is acting. Everyone plays a role, and the role changes. The key to understanding Venetians is rhythm, the rhythm of the lagoon. The water, the tides, the waves. It's like breathing. High water, high pressure, tense. Low water, low pressure, relaxed. The tide changes at every 6 hours." Comment on that one.
Well, I think what he means by that is that the Venetians, living the way they do, so close to water, they have a rhythm of life that is affected by the movements of the tides and the rising or falling levels of water, that, in a way that we probably in most cities just don't get. I mean, they're living in a city where there are no cars, and where the rhythms and even the sounds of water are things that you can really appreciate. So I strongly suspect that they are a people who are really influenced by natural rhythms in a way that residents of most cities aren't. I mean, let's face it, cities are artificial places. They're human-made constructions. With all kinds of noise, with all kinds of confusion, with all kinds of pressure. Not to say there isn't pressure in Venice, but I think it is still a place where the rhythms of life are dictated far more by natural phenomena than they are in any other city that I know of anyway.
And as a stage theater, given its size, given its location, given that it's really cut off from land except by one bridge, and by the way, he points out that there's very little air pollution in Venice.
That's right.
But being that it is such a good stage for theater, the Count also says, and this is in reference to the bridges of Venice, he says, "Do you see a bridge as an obstacle, as just another set of steps to climb to get from one side of a canal to the other?" Which would be
the normal yes.
reaction.
Especially when you're struggling with a number of tourists who are also trying to cross it at the same time.
But he says, "We Venetians do not see bridges as obstacles. To us, bridges are transitions. We go over them very slowly. They're part of the rhythm. They're the links between two parts of a theater, like changes in scenery. Our role changes with as we go over bridges. We cross from one reality to another, from one street to another, and from one setting to another." Now, how does Berent weave this bit of Venetian insider information, if you will, into the real story he encounters, this transition, this changing from one state of being to another?
Well, I think what he means by that is that the Venetians don't really take anything at face value. That, for instance, the case of the burning of La Fenice, they don't believe the official version of events, and their own version of what may have happened shifts and changes with time. So there is a real sense in Venice that they're living in a place where it's pretty difficult to grasp reality, and that you can cross from one bridge to another and you'll find yourself in a different place with a different group of people who may have a very different outlook towards the same issue that is capturing their attention at the time.
Okay, I'm going to give you the last comment, okay, as usual. One commentator who was talking about the nature of literary nonfiction said that it is the literature of actuality, and that inherent in literary nonfiction is the power of the real, mm-hmm, and the deeper resonance of the literary. Mm-hmm. Do you want to comment on that in terms of John Berendt's book, The City of Falling Angels?
Right. Well, he certainly is dealing with a real place. I mean, Venice exists. It's a city of imagination, but it is a real place that you can visit. The characters he wonderfully captures and brings to life in the book are all real people. And yet at the same time, as I've said, when you're reading it, you are getting a very novelistic sense that what you're reading takes on a whole other reality. I mean, these are people who we're unlikely to meet in our everyday lives. He's been able to meet them because he's gone to visit them in Venice. And I'm just wondered all through the book whether people like the ones he describes in this book could exist really in any other place but Venice. And I get a strong sense from him that probably the answer to that is no, that these are people who are made by their environment, who are shaped by it. And I think we should probably say, and I haven't mentioned this, Bob, in our discussion, that the greatest character of all, of course, in the book is Venice itself. And Venice really comes to life as a character, and the way he describes Venice, La Serenissima, as she's known, is a work of love. I mean, Berendt is obviously deeply in love with Venice. He sees her warts and all. She's come down in time from her glory days, but she's still certainly a place worth visiting and exploring, especially when tourists aren't swarming it.
So obviously we recommend this book.
Definitely.
Okay, and I just want to remind listeners that coming up in a few seconds, we're going to replay the interview that Roy did with John Berendt when he was on the show. Now, I know, Peter, that you're off to Italy for a couple of months shortly.
And I hope to go to Venice, too.
All right. Well, I bet you see Venice in a slightly different light.
Probably will in the middle of summer, unfortunately. I have to figure out a way of getting there in January when Berendt went.
Okay, thanks very much, and we will be back with more of Talking Travel Literature when we've read another book.
Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now here's Roy's interview with John Berendt, the author of The City of Falling Angels.
Well, we're back, and we're honored to have Mr. John Berendt, author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, with us today to discuss his latest book, The City of Falling Angels. Good morning, Mr. Berendt.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for joining us today.
Yes.
In your new book, The City of Falling Angels, you begin by telling the reader why, in part, you chose to write about Venice. You say, why Venice? Because, to my mind, Venice was uniquely beautiful, isolated, inward-looking, and powerful stimulant to the senses, the intellect, and the imagination.
Yes. Well, in fact, it's all those things. And I chose it because I had originally written Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is set in Savannah, which was also all those things, also isolated. Now, each of those two cities is a self-contained cultural and emotional environment, which is a wonderful way to place a story because it makes it more vivid, and readers can escape into that into the book that way. But I chose Venice because it's unique, of course, and it's been often remarked that the whole city looks like a painted stage set. In fact, it does. And as you walk around, if you live in Venice, you walk around it every day. You have to walk. There are no cars, obviously. You begin to feel like a player on a stage. And the Venetians act out their own personal dramas. And as they go through, I was talking to a Venetian count who said to me, "All Venetians are acting. We all play roles." He said, "As we go over a bridge, and there are 450 bridges in Venice, it's the bridges are not to us. They're not obstacles to get over. You have to climb over to get from one side of the canal to the other. Yeah. They are transitions in our lives. We go from one reality to another reality, from one role to another role. Our role changes as we go over bridges. Now, that might sound ridiculous, but that's the way he put it. And then he said to me, Venetians never tell the truth. We always mean the opposite of what we say.
It is marvelous. And, you know, you do what travel writers all over the world love doing. You wander through the heart of the destination almost as invisible or as a neutral observer, and yet you become very engaged in the story yourself. Can you tell us how this writing experience was unique or different for you?
Well, was the same genre I had used before in Midnight.
Right.
It was unique because of the locale, and it's also unusual for a travel writer actually to get past that barrier between public and private. I mean, generally, a tourist experiences the public. In other words, the monuments, the buildings, the art, the restaurants, the hotel, the transportation, whatever, the views. What I was attempting to do was to go through that invisible door that takes you to the private Venice. I was interested in not just Venice, but in people who live in Venice full-time, which is to say Venetians and expatriates who have settled there. Because I realized that most of what we read about Venice really isn't about Venetians. The novels, for instance, Death in Venice, The Wings of the Dove, Don't Look Now, all of those are about people passing through. So the uniqueness of this particular book, City of Falling Angels, is really that it treats the people who live in Venice rather than Venice as a plain tourist attraction.
Right, exactly.
So what I was trying to attempt to do is to give a tourist a glimpse inside the palace walls and into the homes of Venetians. And this is, I think, what makes this a different kind of book, actually. It does, in many ways, inform the tourists about things that they want to know about, but also tells them what, you know, they probably won't be seeing firsthand.
Exactly. Now, you arrive in Venice 3 days, or 3 days prior to your arrival, the opera house, the La Fenice, burns down. Now, how did that fire have an impact on your book?
Well, since I was writing the story about the stories in Venice, it was by sheer coincidence that when I arrived in Venice, that the most important opera house in Italy had just burned down, and it had a very important role in the history of opera because five of Verdi's operas were commissioned by the Fenice and first performed there. But it was a signal important event for Venice because not only was this an architectural treasure, but it was the only remaining opera house in Venice. They once had a dozen.
Right.
So there was, it was the last one there, and it was gone. And not only that, there was no major stage left for the performing arts of any kind, for ballet, for concerts, whatever.
Now, what was the short-term and the long-term effects of the fire on Venice itself?
Well, the short term was that they had to find out who did it, if it was an accident compounded by negligence or arson. They decided it was arson.
Right.
And then, of course, they had to have a trial and figure out, you know, what punishment to mete out. But at the same time, they had to go through the rebuilding of it, and they had decided to build it in the very, very form and shape that it had been before. It was going to be as it was, where it was. That's a motto that they came up with. They had used it in the beginning of the 20th century when the bell tower in St. Mark's collapsed. They built it as it was, where it was. They did the same thing with the Fenice. And that was the immediate response to and the immediate impact on the city. It was quite a tumultuous event because Venetians were heartsick about it, and they realized, the mayor said, we must rebuild the Fenice because we have to prove to ourselves and to the world that we are alive, a living city. Without any stage for the performing arts, they really weren't. Their culture was lacking a heartbeat. I mean, because it is the center of beautiful art and architecture,
right,
in question. But all of that was created more than 200 years ago. They didn't have anything of any currency without a stage, and now they they do. They've rebuilt it. So the long-term effects of this are that they have restored an architectural treasure that tourists enjoy seeing, and they have once again given Venice a living, breathing stage for current cultural events.
And as you say in the book, it drove one of the famous glass blowers to the point of just dedicating himself to create works of art over this.
Based on the fire.
Exactly.
This was Archimedes Aguso, who watched the fire from his bedroom window 30 feet from the actual Fenice, across a canal from the Fenice, and he refused to leave the house. The firemen and the police begged him to leave, and his family begged him to leave, but he could tell by looking at the fire, since he had been looking at the fire at his furnace for 76 years, he knew that the fire was not going to come across in their direction. It was going to miss them if it did leap into other buildings. So the next morning, he got up at 5 o'clock as usual, and he went to his glass-blowing factory on the island of Murano, and he started making a series of bowls and vases based on the colors, the swirling colors that he saw in the fire the night before. And when various substances were burning inside the Fenice, they created greens and blues and purples and not just the regular flame colors.
How marvelous, huh?
Yeah, it was quite an astonishing feat of glass blowing.
Now, of
but
course,
it was his way, it was his and in fact, it was his testimony about the
right,
fire.
Of expressing it all, yeah, how beautiful. The perennial question, always seems to be, is Venice sinking?
Well, the technical answer is no, it's not sinking anymore.
Right.
It had been sinking because the weight of cities does press a city down a little bit. But also in the 20th century, for about 30 years, they were extracting water from under the Venice for drinking water, and they realized that they were sucking the city further into the lagoon. So they stopped that, and they pumped water back under it, and they regained an inch. However, what the real problem is the rising sea level.
Right.
Because Venice is built at sea level or slightly above, and whenever there's a very high tide, the lower parts of Venice become flooded, and St. Mark's Square is the lowest part of Venice, as it happens. It's the most famous part of Venice. These floods are happening more frequently. That's the big problem. And what is being done right now is that the whole system of dikes, movable dikes, is being built. This has been on the drawing boards for almost 30 years, and the Italians were arguing about it nonstop. But what it will do is this. Venice is in the middle of a lagoon which is separated from the Adriatic Sea by the Lido, which is a long barrier island. There are three openings to the sea in the Lido, and the water comes in at high tide and goes out at low tide, and thereby flushing the water in the lagoon, keeping it clear.
Right.
Well, when the high tides come, if the high tides are extremely high, dikes will rise up from the bottom of the lagoon on huge hinges and block the ocean or the sea for the duration of the high tide. That's what's going to be the solution, at least for the moderately short term, 30 years or so. And if anything more is needed after that, then they're going to have to deal with it. The technology is there, and it can be done. Venice is in danger of not destruction, but lots of damage when they have a particularly high tide, because all the first floor shops and restaurants have to replace their machinery, and a stove flooded with salt water is no good anymore. So there's that terrible problem, but as far as the city being wiped away, it's not going to happen.
Can you suggest to our listeners and readers how they too can go to the heart of Venice?
What you can do, now, Venice is not much bigger than Central Park, but there are four major nodes in Venice: St. Mark's Square, the Accademia Museum, the Rialto, and the train station. And most of the tourists go from one to the other, to the other, to the other. And that's where all the crush of tourists
right,
are, in
right.
those narrow streets.
Exactly.
All you've got to do is take a right turn or a left turn and walk away.
Get away
and you'll find yourself in a very quiet neighborhood. You'll find yourself in the typical Venetian space. Also, I would suggest that tourists go to there are six neighborhoods, and they all each have, they're called sestieri. go to the one on the far east and the far west. The far east is Castello, and that's a very, very Venetian neighborhood, not often visited by tourists. And Canaleggio is on the western end, near the railroad station. You can find many, 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 many areas of quiet Venetian neighborhoods there. So you just walk away from the main tourist precincts, and you'll find yourself in the typical Venetian town.
Now, some say that they're often a very fine line between fiction and nonfiction. In your experience, is there a similar distinction that can be made between storytelling, travel writing, travel literature, and travel journalism?
There shouldn't be much difference, because it all should be nonfiction. I've written my two books in the form of novels. That isn't to say they're fiction.
Exactly.
But they're structured the way a novel is structured. Scene to scene, this action that carries through. A lot of nonfiction is just episodic. This happened, and that happened, and that happened, and that happened. But with literary nonfiction, you have far greater precise descriptions of people and places, and dialogue, extended dialogue, and you use the literary devices that novelists use. However, there's a lot being made about the line between fiction and nonfiction. And basically, if a book is nonfiction, then it's true. In my first book, At Midnight, I did switch around some of the events in time. It didn't affect the telling of the story.
Right.
It didn't change the facts. But I put a note in my book saying, this is nonfiction. However, I've taken storytelling liberties, mostly having to do with the sequence of events. And with a note like that, then you're explaining this is nonfiction. However, there have been some liberties taken. Now, there's been a case recently where James Frey didn't put such a note in and truly made up a lot of stuff. And that is more fiction than nonfiction.
Now, at Talking Travel, we're committed to telling the stories with as much depth, substance, and clarity as we can. Do you have any advice for young travel writers about how to do this?
Well, it takes a lot of research. You have
that's for sure.
A lot of research, and I think you have to meet people who either live there or who are officials in the place to get the story. That's what will bring travel writing alive, is to go beyond the inanimate descriptions of buildings and art and architecture, and to get into the history, contemporary history or ancient era history, and talk about people. People are interested in people, and right. You can bring a place to life by putting stories that involve people who live there.
How masterfully, and you've done that in both your books, and it's a wonderful book. I thank you for taking the time to share that with us, and the book will be up on our site for those that are listening, and once again, thank you very much, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Good.
Thank you. Well, Mr. John Berendt, author of The City of Falling Angels, we're going to go to break, and when we come back, Mr. Bob Fisher will be filling in for Suzanne Wright, who is still up in Quebec, so hang in with us, don't touch that dial, we'll be right back.